Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Welcome back. Áine Kerr here, sitting in for Brendan. We're joined now by Irish writer John McKenna, who's written a memoir called Father, Son and Brother Ghost that focuses on his turbulent relationship with his father Jack and his beloved brother Jarlett, who passed away due to motor neuron disease in 2005. John, thank you so much for coming into us today. At the heart of this memoir, it's beautifully written, is the story of your father. It was a complicated relationship, which I think a lot of people listening in, you know, will empathise with, but often like an uncomfortable relationship. How would you characterise it growing up?
Yeah, I think it was an uncomfortable relationship. My father was a good man. He was a very good man, and he was a very hardworking man. There's a moment in my life, and there's a moment in the book, actually at his funeral, where I looked at him. He was in his coffin, and he's wearing his suit, and he always wore a suit. And it suddenly struck me that I had never in my, not even in my adult life, my adolescent and adult lives, I had never hugged my father. And I thought it kind of summed up our relationship, because then it struck me, my brother and sister were there, and I knew that they had hugged my father in their adult lives whenever they were meeting him or leaving him. And suddenly in that moment, it kind of crossed my mind that actually the differences that had been between us were not necessarily all his fault, that there was something. And I would put that down to, I think ours was quite a dramatic house. Let's say the relationship between my parents could be dramatic at times. That's one way of describing it. And the root of that drama, I know it was alcohol. My father drank. My mother didn't drink. And again, I suppose when I look back at my father's life, I suddenly saw over the years that there might have been a reason for that. When my father was one, his mother died, and he was taken into care with his brothers and sisters by his grandmother. Then his dad remarried, and the family got back together again. And then when he was, I think, 5 or 6, his stepmother died, which is quite a traumatic start in life. It was something he never spoke about to me. I think he may have spoken about it to my sister. He certainly didn't to me. So it was something that I wasn't particularly aware of. And I suppose one of the reasons I've done the book is to try to finish a conversation that I never had with him in his lifetime, to try to say to him, listen, this is how it was between us. And it was quite fractious at times.
Because the book really gets to the heart of sometimes the unsaid. Yeah. Yes. And it's the conversations unfinished. And there's this moment in the book, though, you're in the car with your dad coming from the hospital where your mom was seriously ill. And you have this conversation that was 3 sentences. What was that conversation?
Yeah, my mother had a stroke. She was in Vincent's Hospital down the road from here. We were heading back to Castledermot in County Kildare, where we lived. And my mother had been speaking on and off about the other children. And I asked him about that. And he said to me, yes, there were 3 stillborn children. They were buried at the bottom of the garden. I don't ever want to talk about this again. And suddenly again, and I suppose that's one of the things, as you grow older, things sometimes click into place in terms of relationships with other people. And suddenly it struck me, my father was a really keen gardener, and we had a really immaculately kept garden in the house that we were born in and grew up in, apart from one bit at the end, which was a wilderness, which we assumed, at least I assumed, was left there for us to play in. The grass was long. And then it suddenly struck me, that's where the babies were buried. And again, this was something neither of my parents had ever spoken about to me. Again, they may have done it to my older brother and sister. But again, it suddenly struck me, this is something I didn't know about my father. I didn't know he'd gone through this. And
because you had a memory of moving house.
I do.
And
when I was
your
5.
Memory of, as a 5-year-old, is this happy occasion. But you did have this memory of your mom standing in the back.
My sister was the one who had that memory. My sister is a couple of years older than I am. And she has a very clear memory of my mother standing in the garden of that house before. We literally moved across the field to a house that had a bathroom. That was the difference. And my sister has a very clear memory of my mother standing in the garden and crying. And you know, if as a kid, if you look at that, you think, okay, she's unhappy about leaving the house and all the neighbours, even though we were only going a field away. But of course, it was about more than that. It was actually about the children who were being left behind and about the memories that were being left behind and about the experiences that both my parents had gone through. Because I obviously wasn't there. The stillborn children were there before I was. But I have, I've concocted or created a scene towards the end of the book where I imagine my father going through that ritual of burying not one, not two, but three children.
Because there was no funeral for them.
No funeral. They were stillborn, so they weren't baptised and given the sad situation of the time. And it wasn't just in our house, you know. There were neighbours all around the village who would have buried their children in old churchyards or, you know, under cover of night. That's how it was. But in our case, it happened to be in the garden.
And you describe a lot of really trauma for your father, and alcohol was probably the symptom. It was a coping mechanism, but at its heart was this trauma. You had to kind of piece together a lot of his childhood, but through the memories really of your sister. You know, like, were you left with a real sense of just somebody who just struggled to cope with a really tough life?
I was, and yet my father never spoke. He never spoke about any sense of regret. He was always grateful for things that happened to him and things he received. And he was grateful for our education and the fact that we got on. So there was that unspoken situation there. And most of that information came through my sister, Dolores. And, you know, he left school quite early. He went to work on the railways, as his father and brother were doing. He went to England to work. He came back. He got very involved in the union movement, which he would all of us have maintained stopped him becoming a station master, which was his ambition. He became a foreman on the railway, never got to be a station master. So there were all of those frustrations. And yet, either because of the kind of person he was or because of the times in which he grew up, this was not something he ever bemoaned. He just had an extraordinary sense of gratitude for the positive things that happened in his life. I suppose the one thing, and again, it's something I regret, and it's an attempt in the book to do it. What he did leave me with was a fear of alcohol. When Angela, my wife and myself, got married 10 years ago, much to my relief and delight, we had a wedding with no alcohol at it. And that's a hangover for me from childhood. My father wasn't a particularly heavy drinker. It was just the effect that alcohol had in the house. It seemed to be the root of all of the dramatic situations that
arguments,
arose between my parents.
Drama, yeah. And you pieced together in the book this picture then of your father's sister, your aunt, Lal.
Yeah, Lal.
And again, that she's someone who will resonate with so many people listening this morning.
Oh, yeah.
She really just became this incredible servant to the family.
When my father's stepmother died, Lal was 12 and she took over looking after the younger children. She went from that to looking after her nieces and nephews and lived with her sister and brother-in-law and looked after them. She went from that to looking after grandnieces and nephews. And it was only when Lal was, I think she was 70, when finally she got her own house. And I only discovered at her funeral, she died very shortly afterwards. She died at the age of 71.
She finally got independence, her
own.
Yeah,
that was her final, that was her first step into independence. And there was a moment, I remember passing through Houston Station on my way home once catching a train, and a man said to me, "I knew your Aunt Lal, and I used to see her walking out," as to use his phrase, "with this young man when she was young, and I always thought they'd make a lovely couple." And he said to me, "I noticed that neither of them ever married." And they didn't. And for Lal, like so many women, it was about looking after someone else's children. And you know, Anya, the first time I heard Lal's name, which was Ellen, mentioned, was in the church at her funeral. Up to that, she was Lal. And I thought that kind of summed up her life, that she didn't even have her own name.
She was a different persona. And how much of that, they're not getting married, they only getting independence at whatever, 69, 70, and dying there shortly after. Much of that was just her sense of family responsibilities. How much of it was patriarchy? How much of it was Catholic Church? Do you think it was just a blend of factors back then at age 12 that had set her into this life?
I think it was a blend. I mean, I think she had this extraordinary, sometimes she could be quite sharp. And I remember as a small kid, because I used to spend a lot of time in the house where she lived, and she'd be quite sharp. And then again, later on, you realise, why wouldn't she be sharp? I think it was partly, you know, if you start looking after small children and becoming the housekeeper at 12 years of age, I think probably by the time you're 20 or 25, it's been ingrained into you. And you know, it's a kind of servitude that becomes part and parcel of your life. And there were so many women. So many. Funny, I thought of Lala. I went recently for the third time to see That They May Face the Rising Sun. And I thought of her in terms of the character there who is working as a farm labourer all his life. And I thought, that reminds me of Lal. She worked for other people all her life.
Did you get to better understand your father through Lal as well? And, you know, through this and writing the book, you know, did you find new empathy, I guess, for your father?
I did, yeah. I mean, that, I suppose that for me, I've been working on this book really seriously since 2009. Now, I have done other things in the interim, but I remember 3 years ago, I had open heart surgery, and I remember thinking the days afterwards, if I get through this, I better finish that blooming book, because I had written and rewritten and rewritten it, because I was trying, it's an attempt really, I suppose, by me to come to terms with those two men in my life, my father, Jack, and my brother, Jarlath. And I thought I'd better do this. And I suppose it's a book I've put out with some trepidation, because neither of them is there to tell their story. And yet what I've tried to do in the book is to give voice to the stories that they had in their lives.
What do you think holds us back? Because if the book is that effort to finish the conversations that weren't finished in life, what do you think in those moments that holds us back from the hard conversations or the hugs with a father?
Fear, I suppose. I've always had... Yeah, this is why, I mean, as I said about that moment at my father's funeral, I've always had a difficulty with emotional connection with people. I just have had that in my life. I think it was, I mean, there were a couple of times in North Carolina, which is where my brother lived, where we would have walked on the beach together and we would have had quite intense conversations. And yet, and many times I wanted to say to him, listen, I you were hugely important in my life. I always saw Jarlath as a kind of a protector against the world for me. I think the fact that he was a doctor kind of was part of it. He seemed to have a cure for everything, though he sadly didn't have a cure in the end for his own disease. But there always came a point where saying, listen, I love you and thank you for what you've done for me. I never seemed, even when he was dying, actually, the first time I think I probably said it out loud to him was the night before he died, and he was in a coma. So I don't know whether he heard me or not. But I thought to myself over the last couple of years as I finished the book, I don't think there's anything else after this life. I just don't have a faith in an afterlife. But I thought, if there is, I would like you to hear me say to you, thank you. I appreciate what you've done for me, and I love you. Yeah, the words are going out there. If he hears it somewhere, brilliant. If he doesn't, at least I've said it.
Yeah, on the eve of his passing. And Jarlath, like, you had siblings, and Jarlath was somebody you obviously loved and adored. He went to boarding school. So you're often just, though, alone, even though you had this amazing brother and
Jarlath
sister.
Went to boarding school. My sister went to boarding school. He went to college. My sister went to France for a year, and then she went on to teach. So for a number of, for actually from the time I suppose I was about 8, I felt a lot of the time like an only child. I was the only child in the house at home. So any of these dramatic situations that arose between my parents, I tended to find myself in the middle of them. And I think this is something actually funny that I may have inherited from my Aunt Lal, Ellen. I felt this sense of responsibility to try to sort out the problems at home and to be the negotiator and to be the intermediary between my parents when they weren't speaking to each other.
It's really hard, isn't it? Though,
it is.
An 8-9-year-old, when you reflect back now as a parent and that responsibility.
And you know, I probably talk about being the only gay in the town. Like, I thought I probably was the only kid in the town who had a situation like this. Now, of course, as I've had conversations with people I grew up with, I find that it was common in so many houses. But at the time, I felt, you know, I'm 8, 9, 10, 11, whatever age, until I went away to boarding school myself. I felt a responsibility for sorting out things and for getting things back on an even keel. And of course, as you grow older, you realise, and I've realised this with my own children and stepchildren, that actually the perception that children have of adults' lives is quite different from the perception that adults have of adults' lives. So what I saw as horrendous and threatening and awful and, you know, possibly the end of the world may have been something quite normal that my parents had just grown into.
And the book obviously gets into the turbulence that came with your dad being the man that he was back then, but the brightness, the lightness, the love comes through with your brother, Jarlett. And it felt like a different house home when he would come back in and you wouldn't have to be the honest broker, the negotiator.
Absolutely. When Jarlett was there and when my sister Dolores was there, it felt like suddenly we were a family again, and I was the youngest and I didn't have to be on the front line in dealing with my parents. I suppose that's the thing about memoir. You know, my memories of those times, if you were to speak to my sister, she would have radically different memories. If Charles were alive, he would probably have radically different memories. But once they were there and once he was, you know, I mean, he was away in college and then he would work the summers in London and he'd come home for a week maybe at the end and he'd come home for a week at Christmas. And those were times when I felt, oh, I can relax now. It's not my responsibility to deal with my parents, actually. Somebody else can handle this for the next week or two. And he had a totally different approach to them. He had a much more, maybe because he was older, and I think it was a personality thing, he just had a more dismissive approach, which was probably a healthier one than mine. But I at least felt, I'm not in the front line anymore. Somebody else can deal with this.
He was your protector. He soaked a lot up for you.
Yeah, I think he did. And whether he actually took it on board or whether he just thought, well, they're adults, let them get on with it and let them sort it out for themselves, I don't know. But the perception to me was, here is someone who can sort things out. Here's someone who can sort out emotional problems, medical problems, can sort out everything, which is a bit unfair to him to put that responsibility onto him. But I think that's why I missed him so much when he died. And I was so grateful that I was with him when he died, you know.
Because there is that lovely bond. You clearly admired him, clearly loved him, clearly depended on him in terms of coming back into that volatile house. He died quickly in the end, and you talked there about talking to him out loud on the eve of his passing. Was there anything in terms of the brotherhood, the brotherly ways, where he would have just instinctively known it? Would you have ever been able to verbalise it? Because I think this is something men struggle with, isn't it? Brother
it
to
is.
Brother, father
there
to
was,
son.
We'd flown over to the States to see him. Now, he'd been diagnosed with motor neuron disease in May, and this was July, just coming July of 2005. And I went to see him, and he was actually in hospital at the time just with a minor infection. And I went to see him and we had a chat about stuff like, you know, football and Bulls talk. And then there came a moment where he in the hospital room, he said, I'm going to turn off the TV. And he pointed the remote at a painting on the wall. And obviously nothing happened. And I realised something's not right here. And I said to him, are you okay? And he said, I'm a bit tired. And I said, do you want to sleep? And he said, the last thing he said to me was, he said, I have my bags packed for the journey. And that was it. And then he went into a coma and he died the following afternoon. And I think in that moment, I've looked back at that moment and I've thought that I was so privileged to be there and I was so privileged to hear him say that. He had a tremendous faith, as did my parents. And I just felt that he had come to a point in his life. He obviously wasn't, and his wife Claire wasn't, and I, but none of the family were looking forward to what might lie ahead. So in a way, I see it as a stroke of luck that he died so quickly. But that one sentence, again, at the end, you know, I've got my bags packed for the journey. I just felt, yeah, this is somebody saying to me, listen, I'm done and dusted here and I'll see you on the other side.
Yeah, how did you feel in that moment? Is it relief? Is it sadness?
I felt great sadness. I knew from that moment that something was changing and there probably wasn't going to be any going back. But when I... I remember coming out of the room later that night, and there was a big, big moon up in the sky in Carolina. And I remember feeling a great sense of relief that he was avoiding what lay ahead. And I also felt that sense of privilege that he'd said that to me, that it was a kind of a goodbye, because, I might not have been there.
Did your faith sustain you at all in those moments of saying goodbye? Like, faith had been very powerful.
I tell you what I did, Anya. I, after my brother died, I made a bargain with God, which is very big of me, right? I said, listen, I'm going to give you a year, God, to prove something to me that there's an afterlife. Now, God smiled, if there is a God, and said, yeah, listen, get on with it, son. And I think really what happened about within, I think, probably 6 or 7 months, I went into a very deep, dark place of depression and grief really, which kind of left me in a state where I wasn't kind of fit to deal with anything really. And it was only then, but I thankfully came out of that eventually. But I suppose I look back on that time as I just feel a great sense of timing that I happened to be with him when he died, and that I got to say the things that I wanted to say, and he got to say that farewell. And that to me was hugely important, because, and that's probably why I wanted to write the book, to say, listen, all those things you did were wonderful things, including saying goodbye.
You're a father yourself now, you have a son, you have a daughter. Do you believe now in having the hard conversations, finishing the conversations here in the real world rather than?
I do, yeah. I think I do. I have 2 children, I have a daughter and a son, and I have 3 stepchildren. And given that they've come through teenage and into adulthood, we've had some hard conversations, as parents do with their teenage children in particular. But I think in all of the cases with all 5 of the children, I have had difficult conversations, but I've felt. Yeah, I felt I'm really glad that I had those conversations, and sometimes they're still going on. And I kind of feel that actually perhaps that's something my father taught me, that it's sometimes necessary to step beyond the comfort zone and to actually have the conversation that is possibly more uncomfortable for me than it was for them. But it's an important way of keeping the channels open. And that's really important.
Do you think it's really important for men to do that as well?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I can only speak as a man, and I do. And it's something I've talked about to a couple of my male friends in particular. I think we're getting better at it. I regret the fact that it took me until I was in my late 60s, I suppose, to get around to doing it. That's one thing I regret, that I didn't do it in my 30s, 40s. But I'm glad that I got the time to at least have those conversations with my own children and stepchildren, yes.
Do you think, having written this memoir, there's a little bit more now of know thyself in?
Oh, yeah,
because
very
you
much
now
so.
Know your father.
Absolutely.
Better.
Yes, I look back at my brother's life, I look back at my father's life, and I realise that actually my father, and I've said it in the book, and I've meant it, it's not kind of just a literary device, he was a far better, stronger, truer man than I have ever been. And that's a fact that I've come to recognise in my own life, that he was a better man, far better man than I gave him credit for, and a better man than I've been. And that's an important lesson for me, and that's something I wanted to say to him.
And so do you strive to be a version of yourself that is the better self all of the time now?
I do, and I fail, and I try again. But I do, yeah. And I think probably in the last 5 or 6 or 7 years I have, and coming through kind of medical situations, I think I've learned things about myself that I didn't know, or at least rather I've accepted things about myself that I knew but didn't ever acknowledge.
Well, continued learning and questioning and memory making. Thank you for that, John McKenna.
Thanks,
and the beautiful memoir that we've just discussed is Father, Son and Brother Ghost. Thank you for that. We'll be back after these.